everybody. Welcome back. We assume you're coming back. If you're here for the first time, well, we're happy to have you. But we are just so glad you're here to listen to Theology on Mission podcast, where theology engages the issues of culture for Christ and his mission. I don't have Mike Moore with me today, ladies and gentlemen. I really don't know what to do in this little segment, we call it in the radio business, segment. It's when we banter back and forth, kind of get in touch with one another as to what's going on in our lives. So I don't really know what to do. You know, Chaz Robbins, he's now our tech guy. He's in the studio. Chaz, when you're running the show, you're in the backseat of your car running the show.
I've only done that once.
Okay, well, that's the most memorable thing I could think of to say about Chaz Robbins. But folks, at least in Mike Moore's place, Chaz said something. That's important.
Hey, there we go. Yeah, I'm here for it. I'm here for the banter. Let's go.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, Theology on Mission podcast, and we have a very, very, can I say very, how many times can I say very special guest? I do mean this. His name is Charles Kaiser. I should call him Dr. Charles Kaiser because I was there, folks, when the moment happened, when he was baptized in academia and became a doctor. He is a pastor at Storyline Christian Community in Dallas, Texas, a network of missional communities. He is a theologian, and he and Elaine Heath have written a book, which I cannot tell you how appropriate this book is for our time. It's called Trauma-Informed Evangelism, Cultivating Communities of Wounded Healers. Trauma-Informed Evangelism. Charles Kaiser, welcome to the show.
Hey, Finch. Thanks for having me.
That's it? That's all you're going to say? Folks, I can remember sitting in the classroom with this guy, and he was a real pain. I mean, he was a thorn in my side. And so I got to tell you, Charles, by the way, it's not good for the host to talk so much. So could you say a little bit more the next time I give you a moment? I can remember thinking, this guy's smart. This guy is, you know, a bit of a wise apple. We had another name for it, but I can't say it on the air. But this book is freaking brilliant. It's off the charts brilliant. Can you tell us what led you to write this book, and out of what experience in your own life led you to this moment where you wrote this book? Because, folks, it's a shame that this book, I mean, Erdmans is a good publisher, but you need to be on those book racks when you walk in to the bookstores. What's it called? Chaz, give me a name of a popular bookstore.
Barnes & Noble.
Barnes & Noble. That's the bookstore I was trying to think of. You need to be on the book rack of Barnes & Noble. That's how good this book is. What led you to write this book?
That's high praise, Finch. Thank you for that. What led me to write this book? So it surfaced out of my doctoral thesis in your DMN cohort. So I feel like that deserves to be said. Elaine was my supervisor for my project.
And by the way, folks, Elaine Heath is the other author on this book. It's Charles Kaiser and Elaine Heath. Okay, go ahead. Sorry to interrupt, Charles.
Yeah, no problem. And that project and then the book that followed came out of joining. We moved to a new neighborhood in our city, and we joined a board gaming group that met on Sunday nights in a local bar. And we were warmly welcomed in and kind of became a part of the fabric of this community. I was not a big board gamer before that. I'm not the like analytical software engineer type, but man, I've grown to really love a good strategy game. And over time, probably 3 years into the relationships with folks in that board gaming network, I was taking Mark Mulder for, this is great plug for your program. I'm not doing this on purpose, but it's just part of my story. I was taking Mark Mulder for ethnography. And so I learned some qualitative research skills there. And then I took a class with Sung Chan Ra on culture. And I thought, man, I want to do some learning about this subculture that is my board gaming group. And so I interviewed about 10 folks in that board gaming group. And it was along the lines of community and like, what makes this community of people tick? There's lots of like non-religious people for whom this is their people. This is their church that's not religious, if you will. And I had one question at the end of that interview schedule that was like, is there anything spiritual or transcendent to you about your experience in this group? And which was not surprising for my friends, because they know me as a pastor at this point. They know that I'm a spiritual person. But predictably, almost all of them who would describe themselves as atheist or agnostic said, you know, I don't really have categories for that. I'm not sure how to answer that. And then almost to a person, they said something to the effect of, but can I tell you the terrible things that have happened to me in church and religion? And it stunned me. It got my attention so much and resonated so deeply within me and broke my heart and stoked my curiosity so much that determined the shape of my doctoral work to learn more about these experiences they were having. I didn't have language for it then, but now I think I'd say I discovered experiences of spiritual abuse and moral injury and religious trauma in my board gaming friends. And so that the book is a product of that discovery in my local context, which, as you were saying, I feel like is, it also connects to this broader cultural moment and crisis of credibility and just all of the dumpster fire that the American church sometimes feels like in our time right now.
So good. Mark Mulder, sociologist at Calvin, that comes and teaches a seminar on ethnography, folks. And it teaches us how to listen to these spaces where we're at, where we live, where the church inhabits. And what a lesson for us all. I remember, Charles, a big gaming group called Hot Sauce Games right across the street, down the main drag of Westmont where I live. And I'd go in there. And I would try like crazy. I'd bring my son Max, and I couldn't the games, man, they were so stinking complicated. Oh man, the powers of concentration. Anyways, but there was something, folks, going on there across these tables. Notice I said tables, where these games were. And these folks were maybe, I don't want to stigmatize all these folks, but I met a lot of people that if you met them out on the street, they probably wouldn't be the real social people. But now across from this game, oh, we're talking about everything. And we had a guy at our part of our church that said, we need to put this gaming thing in our church building. And I go, no, let's leave it where people are already at. But they actually turned out to need another couple of spaces. So one night he opened up our space and it was packed with gamers. Anyways, folks, I wouldn't ask Charles Kaiser to go to the hockey rink and become a hockey coach with me. I've seen his skills on the ice, or actually I haven't, but I've imagined them and they aren't good. And if you haven't got the gift of gaming, like I don't have, Charles actually acclimated to it. I know personally this man has undiscovered intelligences all over his body. Okay, but I couldn't do it. But let this be a lesson. Go to where God's calling you and be present and let God work. Sorry, that I started to preach there. I couldn't help myself, but I got inspired just from listening to you. Fantastic. Give us the main thesis of the book, Trauma-Informed Evangelism, and then we'll delve deeper into some of these questions. The main thesis.
That's like the hardest thing in the world for an author on a project to sum it up. I would say the main thesis is there is, in fact, a widespread experience of religious trauma in our American context today. And the Spirit of God is inviting us to join God, to join Jesus, to join the divine community in healing the wounds of the world. And
that's the book, that's in one sentence. That is in one sentence or less. Folks, that is a sign of a brilliant. No, okay, I think people might think I'm BSing because I'm so familiar with you, but I'm not. That is a sign of a brilliant theologian right there. Summarize a thesis. I say three sentences are left. He did it in about one, maybe one and a half. Anyways, these are the kind of things we learn in the DMIN contextual theology program. How to be a theologian. But anyways, I digress. Charles, I didn't bring you on to be a commercial for our program. I swear I didn't. I am very interested in this book. Let's talk about this idea of trauma. It has become mainstream discourse, but there is a very specialized discourse, almost medical discourse, around the diagnosis of trauma. And there's another discourse around abuse. They overlap. The goal here is to take cultural knowledge, cultural frames, cultural understandings, and test them on a field. And this field was this game room with all these people with all these various forms of abuse. Tell us about trauma, this discourse, and tell us about how it illumines the issues the church is facing. And maybe, you know, if there's some, I actually remember your oral exam, and I tried to get you and Elaine to be a little critical of the use of the way trauma has been used. I didn't get too far, as I recall. Didn't hurt your grade or anything, but tell us about trauma, abuse, and how it helps us. And then maybe we can dig a little bit deeper on some of the where it goes off the rails.
Sure. There are a lot of different ways to describe trauma, and you're right that I'm trying to follow the more clinical and kind of technical understandings of trauma rather than the more colloquial expressions of that traumatized me or triggered me, you know, as code for I was uncomfortable. That's not what we're talking about. One way to think about trauma that I find helpful comes from Bessel van der Kolk, who has written a book called The Body Keeps the Score, which has been a New York Times bestseller for a long, long time. And one of the ways he describes trauma is as the imprint. It's not the thing that happened to us. That would be abuse. That abuse would be the thing that happened to us, or one of the things that could happen to us. Trauma is not the thing that happened to us, but it's the imprint of that experience on our mind and brain and body. And so, like, trauma helps us to see the impact of adverse experiences physiologically and neurobiologically, the way that harm gets lodged into our nervous systems and kind of hangs out, ready to be activated by sight or smell or taste or interpersonal encounter. So religious trauma then in that frame is the imprint of adverse religious experiences on our mind and body and brain. And I think that's really helpful. Like I'll give you an example. You know, you've heard of the fight and flight and freeze and fawn kind of trauma responses. I think about one of our friends, and I'll call him Chris. He wanted to visit Storyline one time. He grew up in this really high demand. He's not sure.
Storyline is a church, by the way, just for everybody.
Yeah. He grew up in this high demand religious environment. Not sure if he should call it a cult or not. And left that and was shunned and totally cut off. So he's got all of this, all of these wounds he's carrying from that. And he wants to come to Storyline. He's self-described atheist at that point. And the Sunday that he comes, he shows up late. He like shows up for the message and the conversation. And after the gathering, he says, "Charles, I'm really sorry that I was late. I actually got here on time, but I could hear the music inside and I had a panic attack in my car." That's a trauma response, right? He had this fight flight anxiety thing bubble up in his body because that's what it took. It activated those experiences of harm in his nervous system. And I think that's a very real experience for a lot of people who have had really hard experiences in a religious context.
Yeah. And so can you go maybe a little further? Okay. We have, you know, because I'm such a post-structuralist Foucauldian, I call it a discourse. I recognize even within the discourse, the clinical or the medical discourse of trauma, there are certain factors going on there that help us understand a sociodynamic, interpret it. We might even see certain power dynamics in that discourse itself, but my main focus for this moment is it helps us understand and see things that in my language opens space for healing and the work of Jesus. That's my words, not yours. But can you tell us, because this is a big part of what we're hoping to train pastors to do, is understand cultural dynamics so that the gospel can become present in a place. So go into that just a little bit more, because I think it's so important in these. I am meeting literally almost, I feel like, every day. Let's say today's Thursday. I've had three conversations this week with people who are hurt, leaving the church, walking around with really reactionary anger over what happened here, here, and here. And they are throwing out the baby with the bathwater. And it's everywhere, folks. And you got to pick up this book, Trauma-Informed Evangelism. It's not just about evangelism. It's about the way the church can be shaped to be a healer in Jesus Christ amidst what we're seeing in the church in terms of spiritual abuse. So just talk about the way the trauma discourse helps us see things we couldn't see otherwise and make space for the gospel.
Hmm. So here's what comes to me, like ways that it's opened space and helped me to see things that I couldn't see otherwise. And that has certainly been the case with these frameworks for trauma. As I reflect back, just on my experiences as a church planner and a pastor, as I reflect back on people's responses to me, in the moment, 5, 10, 15 years ago, I saw there, you know, I kind of received or experienced when people find out that I'm a pastor. In retrospect, I can see their responses to me as trauma responses, like where somebody will boom, they'll blast me, and they'll be like, "Oh, who the do you think you are, buddy?" And then you can tell they're agitated and hyper vigilant. And in the moment, I'm like, what did I do? Oh, my gosh. Like, I'm so sorry. I did not. What did I misspeak or something? A trauma framework helps me to see that as something being activated, and it's not personal to me. Or somebody, I mean, folks that just, I can see the freeze response in them. They kind of, their eyes go wide and they might stop talking and then just walk away. Like, and I've gotten my feelings hurt about that, thinking that that was about me. And trauma helps me see, oh, it helps me to be curious. Like, I wonder what their story is. And man, there, maybe there's some harm in their past experiences. The most common experience or the most common response that I have overheard other pastors or Christians have to what I would describe as trauma responses, but it comes in the form of belligerence or disinterest or apathy or throwing the baby out, however you describe it. The most common response is defensiveness. It is, but wait, oh, I mean, that's not me. That's, or, but that might be that particular church and not all churches, or that might be the church, but it's not God. And we get defensive for good reason, because it means a lot to us. Like it's life-giving to us. We're deeply committed to the way of Jesus. But those defensive responses are not safe or healing to our neighbors who carry religious trauma. We need more empathetic responses to those trauma responses. And it is this movement of empathy and curiosity that opens space for healing and for the unwinding of those harms. When we can receive those trauma responses and see them for what they are, and not judge folks for them or not get defensive about it, but instead enter with empathy and say, I'm so sorry that that happened to you. And you know, that wasn't your fault. That should never have happened. It shouldn't have happened anywhere, much less the church. Just that move, to move in with empathy, is such a big part of the pathway toward healing in the lives of our friends and neighbors who carry this stuff.
This is so huge. I, at times, have experienced being the object of disdain, or the object where, either because I'm a white male, an old white male, or because people perceive me as being unempathetic, say, towards a sexuality issue, gender issue, or racism issue. I've had to learn this very slowly. Thank goodness I've got a very patient wife who, at times, you know, she has to be the one to teach me, Dave, it might be better if you did blank. But, I have learned, dude, through people who write books like you on this, and frankly, we're going through this at Northern Seminary with some trauma-informed training, but, people like, you know, Jeff Holtzclaw, other people in my life, for the last 5 years, trauma-informed has become a way of being that I think can be summarized in one word, Jesus. Okay. In other words, instead of reacting, slow it down, be present, allow the Holy Spirit in this place, listen. And these things unwind and make space for the unwinding of the pain and the hurt. Oh, folks, this is where we're at today in the Church of United States of America, because there are many, many reasons why trauma, coercion, force has been behind how the church has been reacting. I don't care where you're at on the sexuality debate right now, folks, but there's so much trauma amongst LGBTQIA and other alternative person sexualities that because of the way they have been disdained by the church, we need to shut up. be present, listen before we can go. So, Charles, trauma-informed evangelism. Charles Kaiser, Elaine Heath, can we put this in the front rows of every church building in the United States of America? Anyways, all right. There are some causes. Do you have something to say?
Well, I was just, if you'll let me, I'd love to do a little theological move and riff off of your observation.
Yes, that, please.
That trauma-informed is Jesus. Another way to understand trauma comes from Dr. Gabor Mate, who's a medical doctor, trauma expert. And he defined, one of the ways he defines trauma, again, not as the thing that happened to us, but as what we hold inside in the absence of an empathetic witness. It's what we hold inside in the absence of an empathetic witness. So that definition kind of highlights the degree of disconnection that is traumagenic when we feel overwhelmed or totally out of control or powerless over what's happening to us. And so the way that healing comes, conversely, is through the presence of a compassionate witness, an empathetic witness. And so what if Jesus, in his life and ministry, particularly in his crucifixion, if we imagine that as an experience itself of abuse and trauma, what if Jesus is an empathetic witness to the pain of humanity? And he enters that not as an aloof observer, but as a participant in solidarity with the suffering of all who suffer. And so our work as Jesus people is joining Jesus as empathetic witnesses to the pain of our neighbors. That's what I want to do. That's what I want to be a part of.
That's chapter 9 of Trauma-Informed Evangelism. Am I right? Yeah. Okay. We're running out of time, and I have to get to a few things here really quick. Healing the wounds of Christendom. I love this chapter because I see the cultural dynamics of a church that was once in power, in cultural acceptance, a place of cultural respect. The rug got pulled out, and now we got a bunch of defensive Christians trying to enforce their way on what's left of the church, and the result is trauma. Can you go into a little bit about what you're trying to say in that chapter on healing the wounds of Christendom?
I think if I remember right, I think this is Elaine's chapter, and her the beginning of that chapter frames really the vision of the book, that this is that what we're trying to participate in is a new reformation of sorts. Not that we're engineering, but it's the space that's opening up in all of this unraveling, to channel some Roxborough. It's the emergence and the bubbling up of the Spirit in the midst of that unraveling to bring reform and renewal and restoration. Amidst all of the isms of racism and classism, all of the phobias, to bring healing to the wounds that Christendom has caused at this social location, at a center of privilege and power, you know, for the last however many years. So the work of the church ahead is to participate in the healing of those wounds, rather, and to name the way that the church has been complicit in the perpetration of harm. And you asked me, when we texted about this, you said, you know, what are the dangers of this? And I'm being a little coy here. I think the most obvious danger is that this kind of naming and acknowledgement and trauma-informed work challenges the status quo. And I told my wife about that, you know, like, what are the dangers, Julie? And she said, well, what are the dangers of finding out that you have high cholesterol? Like, you might need to change. You might need to do something different. And you know what? That's a danger that I welcome. Like that unraveling, I feel like on some level is necessary for this new reformation of healing to occur.
Okay, I'm getting really inspired, ladies and gentlemen. By the way, he mentioned Al Roxborough, who still teaches in the D-Min, the doctorate, contextual theology. The unraveling of Euro-tribalism and its churches and its frames. So this is so good. I got one last question for you. I got to push back a little bit here. If I didn't,
wouldn't be Fitch.
It wouldn't be the same. Okay. I feel like trauma. Now, this is quite separate from your work in this book, which I find extremely thorough and extremely theological. And I love it. And I want to recommend it to everybody listening. All five of you listening right now, buy this book. Trauma, I have seen it become a discourse that becomes extricate in the church and in churches that I've been part of. It becomes extricated as, and almost like it now becomes the way of healing unto itself. And now everything is seen through the lens of trauma, and this becomes the diagnosis and the cure. And this becomes extremely dangerous, since we're talking about dangers. This becomes extremely dangerous in the hands of people who haven't read trauma-informed evangelism or who haven't read much. Now everything becomes trauma. My husband said a swear word to me, or my wife said a swear word to me last night. Trauma, out of the house. I can't deal with this anymore. And like Sarah Schulman once said, what did she say? All conflict is not abuse. All conflict is not trauma. So how do you, like, you already talked a little bit about Jesus, but I want to end this interview with Jesus. How do we keep trauma under the lordship of Jesus to be a discourse used at the service of Jesus for the healing of people? Because in the end, even therapy can't heal us. Only Jesus can heal us. That's a Fitchism, not a quote from Charles Kaiser. Where are you at on everything I just said about the danger of trauma becoming a discourse unto itself that rules over a church?
I think that's certainly possible. Given how little, well, maybe it's more possible given how little it feels like a lot of churches are trauma-informed at this point. Like, I feel like we're on the front end. And maybe that's part of the conversation about, you know, if you don't know what trauma is and you just use it as a subword for I was uncomfortable or whatever, like that could be, that's problematic for sure. The degree to which trauma could be its own kind of frame or the only frame, certainly all of that's possible. I guess I want to say it is a frame. And it's certainly culturally located. It emerges from a medical paradigm that's based on technique and fixing problems. There's all kinds of problems with the medical paradigm as a paradigm for healing. So we could go into that certainly. How does Jesus fit into all of this? How do we keep trauma from you know, getting out of its lane or becoming an ideology or an empty signifier to channel you and Zizek? I would just say let's go with Elaine's contemplative stance that she talks about in the book and elsewhere in her work. At the end of the day, I would say let's take these frames for trauma and carry them with us in a contemplative posture that Elaine would describe in a fourfold way. Number one, we show up. We show up to God and to ourselves and to others. Number two, we pay attention. trauma gives us some lenses with which to pay attention to ourselves and to others and to God around us. Number three, given what we see as we pay attention, we join in, we collaborate, we participate, we enter in with open hands, with curiosity, and with empathy. We participate with God in the healing of these things. And number four, real tough for me, Enneagram 3, release the outcomes. We don't manage the outcomes of all of this. This is not a new hack for more conversions in the church. We don't manage those outcomes even if we wanted to. We release those outcomes to our neighbors, to their agency, and to the agency of the Spirit of God. I think if we have that kind of contemplative posture, that subverts any frame, trauma included, from becoming the main thing or the only thing or the dominant frame to the neglect of other perspectives.
That was freaking amazing. Amen. That was really good. All right. We gotta wrap this up, but Charles, what are you doing with all this? Are you available to go speak at churches and lead them through workshops? What are you doing? Are you available to come teach courses? By the way, he is a doctor, ladies and gentlemen. So if there's a seminary listening right now, you need to have this guy on your docket. What are you doing with all this? We gotta wrap it up. So do this in like five sentences.
Yep. I would say sentence number one, put me to work. Yes. My website is charleskaiser.com. I'm collaborating with some friends to do more healing. We do workshops. We do cohorts for leaders. I would love to do classes or courses, ways that we can do both trauma-informed leadership and trauma recovery and healing. So, yeah.
That, folks, Northern Seminary couldn't be more proud of Charles Kaiser. And again, the book is Trauma-Informed Evangelism, Charles Kaiser, K-I-S-E-R, and Elaine Heath. We'll have it on the show notes. Hopefully we'll have that other stuff on the show notes as well. We got to wrap this up because we've gone a little long again. You know, where's Mike Moore when you need him? He probably would have shut us down about 10 minutes ago, but Fitch is so long-winded. Anyways, we just want to thank again Charles Kaiser for being on the show. We want to thank you for listening. If you have it within you, give us a recommendation on whatever platform you listen to us on. But for now, and by the way, Theology and Mission Lectures with Jonathan Tran is going to be in Oak Park. I think it's the second week of June. You want to listen to Asian Americans and Capitalist Racism, I believe is the name of the book. But it's much deeper, better than that very boring title. Okay, everybody, thanks for listening. Until next time, it's Mike Moore and Dave Fitch over and out.